It's with great pleasure that I want to introduce D-Van. D-Van and I have been friends for a while, maybe 7 or 8 years. Got to know him in Cambridge. He's currently a lecturer in... Are you a lecturer in philosophy? At Chester University, University of Chester. And also a scholar of Sanskrit and Pali. So D-Van is going to speak to us today about Sangharakshita as Buddhist modernist, the case of the five Nirmas, and I will let him explain to you what that is. So over to you, D-Van. Thank you.
Two things fill the mind with ever new and increasing admiration and awe, the more often and steadily we reflect upon them. The starry heavens above me and the moral law within me. So wrote Immanuel Kant, closing words of the Critique of Practical Reason. Two things fill the mind with new and increasing admiration and awe, the more often and steadily we reflect upon them. The starry heavens above me and the moral law within me. Kant is probably the greatest philosopher of the modern period. And his philosophy represents the complete arrival of a modern viewpoint. The universe for Kant consists in the natural law governing the heavens, the movements of the stars, and of course everything in the sublunary sphere here on Earth. But also there's a moral law governing the human heart. So for Kant, there's no non-human agents. It's not clear that there's a God apart from our belief in him. And if there's room for salvation, it will be in our response to art and imagination. So Kant's at the beginning of a certain movement that led to Romanticism. So in this world of Kant's philosophy, we reach a kind of summary of the kind of intelligent person synthesis of the modern viewpoint. Into this kind of world comes Buddhism in the 19th century. Buddhism arrives, and in order for it to make an impact on men and women in the West who'd read their Kant, it needs to be put in a certain way to meet this expectation. And I want to explore today how the teaching of the five Nirmas gives us a case study of the reception of Buddhism into the West. The five Nirmas, which most of us will be familiar with as something of a signature teaching in the Sangharakshitavada, in the school of Sangharakshita. It's got some background which gives us an insight into the subtle changes that have gone on in understanding Buddhist doctrine, let's say, which give us a sense of how Buddhist modernism is at work, perhaps in a slightly unexpected way, even in Sangharakshita's teaching. Hence my title, Sangharakshita as Buddhist Modernist, the case of the five Nirmas. I've got so much to say, in a way, I couldn't even plan my talk. I had this realisation this morning. But I have got a big handout to lean on. So hopefully you can all see this big handout. And it consists in six sides with various longish quotations, which we'll look at. And I'll draw out the quotations, really. So the handouts are in a chronological order, but for the sake of our engagement, we're going to turn over the page to the second side, Mrs. Rhys Davids and the Five Nirmas. So in 1912, Caroline Augustine Foley Rhys Davids published Buddhism, A Study of the Buddhist Norm. A reprint of the book's on the table there. Maybe Sangadara can hold it up. A slim volume of Edwardian prose. And I so like the typesetting. I've reproduced it here. I've just copied it. So Mrs. Rhys Davies was the wife of the founder of the Parley Text Society, Thomas Rhys Davies, but a Parley scholar in her own right, who lived quite a bit longer than her husband, and whose exposition of Buddhism had quite an effect on Sangharakshita. He gave an encomium on Mrs. Rhys Davies. It's in his seminar called The Endlessly Fascinating Cry. And it may even get published in the complete works, I'm not sure, which he praises her contribution. And read this, we'll see why. So she's writing about the Buddhist vision of reality. Now the Pitakas, which is to say the teachings, the baskets of teachings, they do not assert, but they leave it clear enough that in the organic universe, right and wrong, and those consequences of actions which we call justice, retribution, compensation, are as truly and inevitably a part of the eternal, natural or cosmic order as the flow of a river, the process of the seasons, the plant from the fertile seed. Going farther than the modern scientific standpoint, they substituted a cosmodicy for a theodicy, a natural moral order for the moral design of a creative deity. So I'll throw in two just points there to illuminate just that first paragraph. Firstly, Mrs. Rhys Davies is making the claim that the Buddhists in the Pitakas, they assert that morality and the results of actions occur as part of the natural order. It's just what you'd expect if you were a naturalist in the modern Western sense. The scientific naturalist worldview in which the intervention of God is no longer required to make sense of things. She's saying that's already there in Buddhism. But she says going farther than the modern scientific viewpoint. So we should read this to be saying that firstly, her account of Buddhism is going to be completely in accordance with scientific rationalism. It's going to attract those who believe in science. But nevertheless, it's going to offer something more. So this is Buddhism as scientific rationalism plus the Dharma, plus more. So how's it going to do that? As she says, this order which Buddhism saw in the universe was called in Pali Niyama. That is, going on or process. In it, five branches, strands, phases were discerned. Kama Niyama, order of act and result. Utu Niyama, physical inorganic order. Bija Niyama, order of germs or seeds, physical organic order. Chitta Niyama, order of mind or conscious life. Dhamma Niyama, order of the norm. Or the effort of nature to produce a perfect type. She admits this fivefold synthesis does not occur in the Pitakas. And then she gives a bit of background to explain how she's derived this teaching from early Buddhism. She concludes, so this is right at the end of this extract, hence we may define the Dhamma Niyama as the order of things concerned with the production by the cosmos of its perfect or norm type. And we may say that our notion of moral law is covered by the first and last branches of the fivefold order, namely the why we should be good by the Kama Niyama and the why we try to better our good by the Dhamma Niyama. So there we have it. Mrs. Rhys Davies has discovered in Buddhism the natural law that Kant saw above him in the stars in the form of the physical, inorganic and organic order and the order of mind. So the Utu Niyama, Bija Niyama and Chitta Niyama. And she discovers the moral law in the Kama Niyama and the Dhamma Niyama, corresponding to Kant's moral law. Mrs. Rhys Davies gives us an account of Buddhism as a completely modernist, kind of compatible with modernism, let's say. We could notice, actually not so obvious, is that when she was writing 1912, it was the end of a period in the late 19th century when some British philosophers, now called the British Emergentists, were developing an account of trying to explain the world, you could say, in terms of 19th century science, in which they saw reality as being ordered into various phases emerging from a basic sort of materiality. So the basic material of the universe is responsible for the stuff there emerging from the organisation of matter arises objects, and emerging from the interaction of basic objects arises life with its own laws. So they see a sort of nested hierarchy of orders of being. Mrs. Rhys-Davids, I think, understandably, sort of sees the Utunima, Bijanima, Chittanima as reflecting that kind of hierarchy of orders. But she adds on to the scientific account, the Kamanima, the Dhammanima, the order of actions and results, and this effort of the cosmos to produce a perfect type. Now, you wouldn't perhaps recognise, however, here's my second point, is that reading this, you might think that in some sense she's got this from early Buddhism. But when we actually look at the sources she gives, we see a rather different picture. So this is not to undermine what Mrs. Rhys-Davids has discovered, but just to contextualise it a bit. Now let's go back to the first page. Buddhaghosa on fivefold Niyama. Buddhaghosa is the great Theravadin commentator of the 5th century of the Common Era, South Indian but lived in Sri Lanka. He really was a great thinker, philosopher, everything, as well as sort of Buddhist practitioner. And it's in his commentaries, plus in some other Abhidhamma works, that we see this teaching of the five Niyamas. It's a very standardised teaching. What I've put here is more or less the whole thing. Buddhaghosa is commenting on a particular old Buddhist text. It's a quote from the Mahapadana Sutta, a long discourse in the Digha Nikaya, in which the former Buddha Vipassi is giving an account of his life. Or actually, he's giving an account of what happens to all Buddhas, by definition. So in the early Buddhist tradition, they developed this story that there's not just one Buddha. Buddhas kind of occur from time to time in the unfolding of the vast unfolding of the Buddhist universe. Vipassi was 7 Buddhas ago. Vipassi says, "Monks, it is natural that when the Bodhisattva descends from the Tushita to heaven, that he enters his mother's womb, and that the 10,000 world system quivers and quakes and shakes. In this case, it is natural. It's dhammata, which you could also translate, it's to be expected." So this Buddhist text is making the point that there's a sort of way Buddha's lives unfold. So it's just how it is that bodhisattvas, at their end of their penultimate lives, which are spent in heaven, in the Tushita heaven, they descend from that heaven and they enter their mother's wombs for the last time, because of course Buddhas don't get reborn. And then at that moment, it's such an important moment for the cosmos that there's an earthquake, massive earthquake, like this kind of symbolism we also find in the New Testament, where there's an earthquake at the death of Christ. Obviously earthquakes have a big effect on the human imagination. This is part of a whole list of significant events in any Buddha's life, which it's to be expected, it's natural that this happens. And some of them are accompanied by earthquakes, but not all of them. So Buddhaghosa sets it as his task to comment on this word dhammata, natural. So what he says, in this case, it is natural means that when he enters his mother's womb, it is said that it is natural, it is nature, it is a regularity. And this word regularity is translation of niyama, which we could also translate necessity. And this regularity is fivefold, consisting of the regularity of kamma, the regularity of seasons, the regularity of seeds, the regularity of mind, and the regularity of the way to awakening. So I've translated Dhamma here as the way to awakening. What happens to Buddhas just before they gain awakening? In this regard, the regularity of kamma means the giving of agreeable results for one who is skillful and the giving of disagreeable results for one who is unskillful. So good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad. To illustrate his meaning, one should see the stories connected with the stanza, "Not in the Sky," which is a stanza from the Dhammapada. So he's pointing us to the commentary on the Dhammapada, where there's lots of stories about karmic retribution. These are pre-modern stories, and here's one. There was once a woman who, having argued with her husband and become bewildered, wishing to die by hanging herself, put her neck into a noose. A certain man, who was sharpening a knife, seeing that woman's actions, and wishing to cut the noose, rushed up to relieve her, crying, "Don't be afraid." The rope appeared to be a poisonous snake, and he ran away terrified. The woman died right there. There are many illustrative stories beginning in this way. Get it? This is the world of medieval Buddhism, where if you can't explain anything, you say it's to do with their past karma. Yeah. So in this case, this man's past karma meant he saw a rope as a snake. Yeah. This woman's past karma means that she wishes to die, having argued with her husband. Yeah, this is what we're illustrating. I don't know how many of you would agree, but I'd say this is a kind of view of action and result which we struggle to take seriously now, that the world works like this. But it has to be emphasised that this is the pre-modern Buddhist worldview. It's wrong to say everything happens according to karma, but a lot more than you might expect is down to your past karma. Very quick. Okay.
Well, we might be sceptical about karmic explanations in some cases, but not all cases.
Right, yeah.
Which is, I think, where I am.
Okay, yeah. So we might find this kind of story less illustrative than others. Thank you. This is what he means by kamma niyama, broadly speaking. Good results coming to after good actions, bad results after bad actions. Then he goes through the other let's call them niyamas. The way trees come into fruit and flower and so on all at once in certain countries and at certain times. The blowing of the winds, the fierceness and gentleness of the sun's heat, the weathers being rainy or not, the opening by day and closing by night of lotuses. This and more is the regularity of seasons. Seasonal regularity. Only rice comes from rice seed, only a sweet taste from anything from something sweet, only a bitter taste from fruit that is bitter. This is the regularity of seeds. Whatever former phenomena, which are mind and mental events, are the conditions for whatever later phenomena, which are mind and mental events, through being their support condition, such that there is the production of eye consciousness and so on, and what is in agreement and so on without interruption. This is the regularity of the mind, the citta. That's obscure because it's a summary of a very technical discussion of perception according to Abhidhamma Buddhism, a kind of sophisticated psychology explaining how the mind works. But again, you couldn't describe it as anything like modern psychology. It's drawn from principles such as the momentariness of mental events, which belong to a Buddhist worldview, a pre-modern Buddhist worldview. So then finally, however, the occurrence of the shaking of the 10,000 world systems and so on, when bodhisattvas descend into their mother's wombs, this is called the regularity of the way to awakening. And he concludes, here, among these five kinds of regularity, The regularity of the way to awakening is what is meant. Therefore, the Buddha speaks the words beginning, monks, it is natural, showing just that meaning. To sum up, Buddhaghosa, he wants to explain what sense it's natural or to be expected that these things happen, these events happen in the lives of Buddhas. And then he goes through a list of five ways things have to happen, five kinds of necessity or regularity. So there's the way karma has to have a result, and there's the way seasons have to go in certain cycles. And there's the way seeds always lead to the sprouting of certain kinds of plants. You know, you can't get barley from a rice seed. You're going to get sweet juice from a sugar cane, and so on. So there's a sort of regularity in how seeds work. And there's a regularity in the way the mind works. If it didn't work in this regular way, we wouldn't have a shared perceptual world. But, he says, none of these kinds of regularity are quite what's going on in the life story of the Buddha. Here, the regularity is specifically of the way to awakening of Buddhas. So my understanding here is that from our point of view now, what Buddhaghosa means by Dhamma Niyama is a sort of narrative regularity. So when we tell the story of Buddhas, this story is always the same. It always involves certain events, that the Buddha descends from the Tushu to heaven, his mother dies after 7 days, the young Buddha takes 7 steps, and he goes forth into the homeless life, and so on. So it looks to me like Buddhaghosa's account of fivefold niyama here, fivefold niyama, is a sort of hermeneutic device, meaning a device to allow him to interpret this idea of Dhammata in the Mahabodhana Sutta and elsewhere. So fivefold niyama, a kind of hermeneutic device. It's never connected with the idea of conditionality or dependent arising. It's the word niyama doesn't have that kind of largeness, if you see what I mean. It just means regularity. So now, when we think about Mrs. Rhys Davids, she's done an amazing thing, hasn't she? She's taken a list, which we might easily skip over these days. We might easily not see anything in it except a pre-modern sort of hermeneutic device. And she's seen in it a way to link up Buddhism with the modern worldview. So would it be so crazy to call this a creative mistranslation? When I was introduced to this concept of creative mistranslation, I thought, well, that's a bit, it's like a contradiction, isn't it? Well, I suppose what I'm interested in this talk is are the forces at work in that kind of movement. Seeing in a pre-modern text a way of understanding it which does something we find useful now. So Mrs. Rhys Davids has found in the idea of the regularity of seasons the idea of a physical inorganic order of the universe, a way the universe works. She's seen in the regularity of seeds a physical organic order in the universe. She's seen in the regularity of citta, the mind, the way the mind works. And she's seen in the Dhamma Niyama, the effort of the universe to produce its perfect type. Mrs. Rhys Davids' reading of that fivefold Niyama has actually had a really big effect on modern Buddhism. We might be familiar with it mostly from Sangharakshita's teaching, but when one looks around into sort of popular, but even sometimes quite philosophical books on Buddhism and the understanding of karma, lots of them, even like a philosophy book by David Kalupahana, a Buddhist scholar, say things like, Buddhism teaches there are 5 orders of cause and effect in the universe. Now, what that means is that Mrs. Rhys-Davids says. Yeah, because she's actually given rise to this doctrine. But it's become a sort of normal way to understand Buddhism. So there's a next step to the development of this idea of the five niyamas. And it's in another Buddhist monk called Narada Thera. So this is the third page. A modernist Theravadin on the five niyamas. This is interesting because Narada Thera, it might be Narada. I'm not quite sure how you pronounce his name. Anybody know? Let's say Narada. He's a bit of a fall guy in Bhante's memoirs. If you read his India memoirs, he comes across Narada Thera from time to time, who's a kind of senior Sri Lankan Theravadin monk. And he almost always acts in embarrassing ways. On one occasion, Bhante asks him to admire some images, Buddha images, I think it's that. And Narada says, "I'm sorry, we monks are not allowed to enjoy beauty." Which becomes a turning point for Bhante's reflection on the role of beauty in the Dharma life. And another occasion, I think Narada comes to eat dinner somewhere and it's gone midday. It's gone past midday. So really, technically, a Theravadin monk shouldn't have a meal. So Bhante puts the clock back. The monk turns up and they just don't talk about the time. They don't talk about the time. At least Bhante to reflect on monastic formalism, the absolute pointlessness of this kind of nonsensical rules, especially when you don't keep them. But funnily enough, what we'll see in this quote from Narada is rather relevant. He wrote a book called The Buddha in His Teachings, popularizing Buddhism in not only Sri Lanka but for all over the world. Buddhism does not assert that everything is due to karma. There it is, he said it. According to Buddhism, there are five orders or processes, niyamas, which operate in the physical and mental realms. Then he summarises Utu niyama, Bija niyama, Kama niyama, more or less reproducing Mrs. Rhys-Davids. It's a bit weird. He stresses how Kama is inevitable. And then in the paragraph beginning, inherent in Kama, inherent in Kama is also the continuative principle. Manifold experiences, personal characteristics, accumulated knowledge and so forth are all indelibly recorded in the palimpsest-like mind. All these experiences and characters transmigrate from life to life. Through lapse of time, they may produce, I think, infant prodigies and wonderful children who speak in different languages without receiving any instruction. And they're noteworthy examples of the continuative principle of Kama. Certain phenomena which might otherwise be surprising, you know, children speaking languages when they're very young and so on. He explains that through the power of Kama working between lives. I don't know if that counts as a naturalistic explanation or a supernatural explanation. I suppose it's somewhere in between, isn't it? The way he takes Dhamma Niyama, order of the norm, is a bit broader than Mrs. Rhys-Davids. The natural phenomena occurring at the birth of a bodhisattva, gravitation and other similar laws of nature, the reason for being good may be included in this group. It's a bit hit and miss, perhaps. And under Chitta Niyama, he includes processes of consciousness, constituents of consciousness, powers of mind, including telepathy, telesthesia, retrocognition, premonition, clairvoyance, clairaudience, thought reading, and other psychic phenomena which are inexplicable to modern science. What Narada Thera contributes here is the idea that Buddhism does not assert that everything is due to karma. And my understanding is that this is exactly what Sangharakshita picked up from the five niyamas. In fact, that's in a way the first point of the five niyamas in the way Sangharakshita presents it, is to show that Buddhism doesn't teach that everything that happens is due to karma. But it turns out that this is something like a Buddhist modernist reading of Buddhism. Before the modern period, the principle of kamma or karma, in at least in Indian Buddhism, and I think probably more widely in Buddhism, was in fact the main explanatory principle for how things work in the universe. Like the Abhidharma Kosha, which is the treasury of Abhidharma by Vasubandhu. It's a great work of Sarvastivada in Abhidharma. It explains very clearly how the entire universe evolves through the workings of karma. So all the living beings in the whole universe are there through the working out of past actions. So karma has a sort of function a bit like evolution in the modern worldview. Does that make sense? I mean, it's not directly like it, because karma works so differently. So for Vasubandhu, there's what he calls a receptacle world. There's this sort of bare structure of planet and trees and laws. And into that, all the living beings arrive plup, as a result of their past karma and live out their lives, making new karma. And on it goes. An awful lot happens according to karma for pre-modern Buddhism. But in the modern period, that isn't going to wash, I don't think, for anybody who's taken on board scientific naturalism. We've got explanations for how the world works now, which convince us enough, sufficiently. We're probably not going to put that aside to take on board a worldview based on the unfolding of karma. So we can see that Narada, as a sort of apologist for Buddhism in the modern world, it's quite important to say that not everything that happens is because of karma. And then he appeals to the fivefold Nyama to show that here's Buddhism saying this very thing. Of course, actually, it's Mrs. Rhys-Davids saying this very thing, who had creatively mistranslated Buddhaghosa. But nevertheless, this is how the Buddhist modernist worldview is developing, is coming into being. Actually, two more points about that. Firstly, the fact that Narada Thera took such an interest in the fivefold Nyama gives us a nice case study in something that McMahon explores, which is that Buddhist modernism isn't just Western. So Narada is a Sri Lankan who's trying to modernize Buddhism in Sri Lanka, trying to make Buddhism meet the needs of the modern world. I don't think he was wanting to, as it were, deliberately import the language of science into Buddhism. He was just an educated Sri Lankan, as it were, who wanted Buddhism to do well in a country which had been heavily missionized before independence. Second thing, personally, I see in Narada Thera's account a very rationalist interpretation of the fivefold Nyama. There's not a lot of room for anything other than rational explanations, even for the arising of Buddhas. So it's a kind of rationalist Buddhism as well. And we didn't quite see that in Mrs. Rhys-Davids. She was interested in the effort of the cosmos to produce a perfect type, whatever that means. And if we now turn to page 4, to Sangharakshita on the five Niyamas, we see even less commitment to thoroughgoing rationalism. I believe that the first discussion by Sangharakshita in print on the five Niyamas is in The Three Jewels, published in 67, written, of course, in India before he came back in 64. We have to assume that he read about this through his wide reading in various Buddhist texts, which would have included Mrs. Rhys-Davids' book on Buddhism and Narada Thera's book. Bhante writes, "The Nikaya Agama discourses represent the Buddha as repeatedly condemning the doctrine of fatalism and as declaring that though he teaches that every willed action produces an experienced effect, he does not teach that all experienced effects are products of willed action or karma." This important distinction is elaborated in the formula of the five nirmas, or different orders of cause and effect, or conditionality, obtaining in the universe. They are Utu Niyama, physical inorganic order, Bija Niyama, physical, organic or biological order, Chitta Niyama, non-volitional mental order, Karma Niyama, volitional order, and Dharma Niyama, transcendental order. To distinguish effects produced by one Niyama from those produced by another is not always easy. Some effects can in fact be brought about by any Niyama. Suppose there is a man suffering from fever. The complaint may be due to a sudden change of temperature, Utu Niyama, to the presence of a germ, Bija Niyama, to mental strain or worry, or to tension due to experiences taking place in the dhyanas, Chitta Niyama, to the fact that in a previous life he had harmed someone, Karma Niyama, or to chemical and cellular changes occurring in the body consequent upon transcendental realization, Dharma Niyama. I don't perhaps need to say too much, but we see that Bhante's picked up this doctrine, but it's growing a bit, isn't it? Mm-hmm. The main way it's grown, and this is really important, and this is a step beyond either Mrs. Rhys-Davids or Narada, is that he's identified the five Niyamas with orders of conditionality. So this is a connection that wasn't made before. He's connected the main teaching, main intellectual teaching of the Buddha, dependent arising, conditionality, now with a teaching about how the world works. The world works according to dependent arising, according to conditionality. He's implicitly identified conditionality with the principal underlying scientific explanation of cause and effect, and then brought in these five orders to explain, as it were, aspects or dimensions of cause and effect working its way out in the world. So these five orders of conditionality. So we've got a kind of worldview now developing, which I don't think was quite there before. Here we have the Sangharakshitavada kind of coming into being. And at this point is that what exactly is meant by Dharma Niyama is at this point a bit supernatural. These chemical and cellular changes. We never heard much more about this, did we? I don't think, in Sangharakshita's teaching. But I think the most important thing that Bhante was bringing out, emphasising with the five Niyamas, is this opposition to fatalism. Because of the five Niyamas, Buddhism is not fatalistic. Everything doesn't happen because of karma. You've always got a choice. It goes a lot further, actually. It gives a method for working out how you can tell if what's happened to you is through karma or not. This is halfway down the next paragraph. Only after making every attempt to remove a certain condition and finding that although other circumstances are favourable, an unknown factor frustrates all our efforts, are we entitled to imply the method of residues and conclude that the other Niyama... The condition is due to karma. Thank you. So he gives us a method for telling if something's due to karma. The method of residues comes from John Stuart Mill, his book, A System of Logic, 1845. One of our British emergentists, philosophers. And I've given you the quote. In short, when you're trying to work out, from a scientific point of view, you're trying to work out the reason something happens. If you tried explaining something, if you've brought in all your explanatory factors and it still doesn't work, you're justified in bringing in the as yet unused explanatory factor. That's that, according to residues.
Is that a version of Occam's razor?
No. Not quite. I'd say it's a bit different. It's not terribly important. It's just interesting to see where Bhante was getting a creative idea here from John Stuart Mill. No, I won't get into Occam's razor right there. Actually, Banti does finish that discussion with a curious sentence. Despite the contrary impression sometimes created by modern Theravadin writers, the five niyamas not only all act upon one another, but are collectively acted upon and influenced by the higher and wider containing reality of the universal consciousness, the Alaya Vijnana. I'm very intrigued by how in the three jewels, Sangharakshita at that time was espousing a sort of idealist philosophy. Don't know if you'd agree, Vidyaruchi. That was his sense of the worldview of Buddhism, which exactly how the Alaya Vijnana fits with the five niyamas, he doesn't go into here. I suspect that when he's referring to modern Theravadin writers, this is probably Narada Thera again. And probably what he's getting at is that rationalism in Narada Thera. That unlike that terrible, hypocritical, formalist Narada, the proper way to understand the five niyamas is including a much bigger sense of reality, which you can't really put into lists of cause and effect. There's a bigger reality of mind which goes beyond the reason. I'm not entirely sure, but that's my reading.
Is that kind of, so later on, Bhante's version of the Dharma Nira kind of becomes that, takes into
Exactly, that's it. So actually we'll now turn to page 5, that very thing. I don't think Bhante had the chance to write about this, but so Subhuti's paper, Revering and Relying Upon the Dharma, is the way in which Bhante's later understanding of the Dharma, we can appreciate it. I've given you a long extract, but I'll just maybe summarise it. So, the Revering and Relying Upon the Dharma, he describes it as a paper, doesn't he? Subhuti describes it as a paper. It's published in 2010. Subhuti describes it as Sangharakshita's reflections on our philosophical view, our fundamental philosophical position. So it's clear that the five niyamas remain fundamental to Bhante's understanding of the Dharma. And they remain fundamentally connected to Pratityasamutpada in Sangharakshita's understanding of the Dharma. So Subhuti writes, Pratityasamutpada, which is dependent arising conditionality, means that there are discernible patterns of regularity between conditions and what they condition. And these patterns of regularity can be grouped into five categories, the five niyams, Utubija, Mano, Kamma and Dhamma. So the word Mano has been substituted for Chitta. I think it doesn't make any difference. And now the Utu Niyama, Bija Niyama and Mano Niyama are more or less equated with what's described by the laws of physics and chemistry, the laws of biology and the laws of psychology. So what Kant would describe as natural law, the natural laws describing the world and everything living in it. That leaves the Kamma Niyama and the Dhamma Niyama, which are now linked up to higher evolution, whereas the three lower first niyamas are connected with the lower evolution. Now Kamma and Dharma Niyamas are linked with the higher evolution of the individual. So we do see this coming together of ideas. I'm just going to read out the bit on Dhamma Niyama, which undergoes a bit of a development. The Dhamma Niyama is presented in the source commentaries as accounting for such matters as why a world earthquakes takes place at each of the major stages in the Buddha's career. More recent Theravadin discussions seem to understand it as the fundamental principle of conditionality itself, inclusive of the others, or as a sort of miscellaneous category to take care of what doesn't fit elsewhere. But he's referring to Lady Sayadaw and other Ledi, that's a Burmese Abhidhamma teacher. Sangharakshita, however, reads much more specific meaning to it. The Dhamma Niyama comprises those conditioned processes by means of which Buddhas arise. These processes are represented especially by the sequence of positive factors that arise at stream entry. It is, one might say, the stream that one enters. He goes on, Buddhahood is not a random event, nor is it given. It is gained by establishing a sequence of conditions, each succeeding one arising out of the preceding in accordance with Pratitya-samutpada. One attains Bodhi by exploiting regularities inherent in reality. The capacity for enlightenment is part of the way things are. So, in this final development of Sangharakshita's teaching on the five niyamas, the Dharma niyama's been connected up now with the progressive trend, as he describes it in Pratitya-samutpada, the spiral path, the possibility of dependent arising working not only to describe how the world works and the arising of dukkha or suffering, but also how the way to awakening works. I think technically he only means Dharma Niyama to connect with those factors that arise after insight, which therefore don't arise through any volition, that arise non-volitionally. We see a connection back with Mrs. Rhys-Davids actually, and her idea of the Dhamma Niyama as the effort of the universe to produce a perfect type. Except now it's Bhante's linked up Dhamma Niyama specifically with the sequence of conditions that leads to awakening. And yet, in revering and relying on the Dharma, it becomes clear that this Dharma Niyama shouldn't be understood as a rational process. Rather, Sangharakshita even brings in the simile of a force or power working through the universe, as it were, has worked through him to found the Triyatana Buddhist movement. So it seems to me that there's a pushback there within this quite rational teaching against rationalism as the ultimate explanation of awakening. It's broadly a kind of an account of Buddhism which is within scientific naturalism, but nevertheless, at the end point, it transcends it. We might not have expected such a completely clear-cut engagement with scientific naturalism within Sangharakshita's teaching of the Dharma. But it seems to me that, in fact, that engagement with the challenge and the opportunity of modernism as scientific naturalism is woven into Sangharakshita's presentation. So I'll end with just three thoughts about this, because we're out of nearly 1 hour, but not quite. The three thoughts relate to the degree to which this kind of modernism is deliberate or conscious on the part of Bhante or Narada Thera or Mrs. Rhys-Davids or anyone else. And my feeling is that it doesn't need to be. There's other forces at work. So the first force is the desire to express the Dharma in a way that simply works for modern people. And that desire doesn't need to be thought through. It's more or less, it's the response of compassion, as it were, in the teaching situation. So we could understand this development of the teaching of the five niyamas as skillful means. That leads to the question of, well, is skillful means always good if it's made up, if it's a creative mistranslation? And my thought there is that Buddhist hermeneutics is an open business. Yeah? We see this in the tradition itself, that when a new teaching is introduced, those who introduce it come up with a new way to interpret the Dharma. So, very well-known example, in the Sangdina Mochana Sutra, the Buddha explains these brand new ideas about mind only by saying, aha, there were three turnings of the wheel. First turning, noble truths. Second turning, emptiness. That wasn't the whole truth. There's now a third turning, only available to you special people, which is the teaching of mind only. So I'm not suggesting a fourth turning or anything like that here. I'm just suggesting that Buddhist hermeneutics is always open and progressive. And that's part of Buddhism. So our skillful means could also be justified if it's an interpretation of the teachings that's well done. My third thought, just to finish, is that actually Buddhism, right from the beginning, right from the Buddha himself, has always been naturalistic. In the Buddha's day, so long ago, 2,500 years ago, it's not just pre-modern, it's like just at the beginning of the Iron Age. The Buddha was expressing the Dharma as best he could in that context. And if you look carefully, if you read it carefully, the Buddha was relatively naturalistic. He preferred explanations in terms of cause and effect over explanations of events involving supernatural entities. He certainly preferred explaining the way to awakening in terms of ethics, meditation, wisdom, rather than sacrifice or deities or reliance on scriptures. So actually, naturalism is Buddhist. And the fact that our naturalism now is so much more better developed through the discoveries of science is actually an opportunity for Buddhism to naturalize itself even more. So what I offer you to end is that this development of the five niyamas as a fully naturalized kind of way of understanding Buddhism is actually in line with quite deep tendencies in the whole Dharma. Thank you.